pause a second, breathe. So it's the 6th of September, and this is a teleconference on the Idealized Self-Image Pathwork Guide Lecture 83, including information from the Higher Self, Lower Self, and Mask Pathwork Guide Lecture 14. So again, I'd love to have anyone who's willing to introduce themselves and say what part of the globe they're from. And you are welcome now and at any point to ask any questions that you might have. So please just speak up.
Okay, this is Janet calling from Houston, Texas, and I'm sure I will have questions a little bit later in the program.
Welcome, Janet.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Kristen Craig, and I am from Dallas.
Welcome, Kristen.
Hi, I am Gladys from California. Hello?
Welcome, Gladys.
Oh, hi.
This is Harry Davis from Marshall, Texas.
Welcome, Harry.
This is Wendy from Forbes, Australia. I do have a question in that I'd just like to know what self-talk's going on when the idealized self-image is working.
Okay.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's a good question.
Thank you.
This is Jeanette from Sydney.
Welcome, Jeanette, and by the way, welcome, Wendy.
Thank you.
Okay. If anyone else comes on the line, oops, there's somebody there. Would you like to introduce yourself? We've just started.
Hello, this is Larissa from South Australia. Hello, everybody.
Welcome, Larissa.
Thank you.
Okay. So we'll get started, and I get a little stage fright sometimes, and I don't remember to hear the ding and recognize that somebody else came on. It is my intention to pause and let anybody else who comes online introduce themselves, but like I say, I get a little nervous and I forget sometimes. So declare the intentions, hope that that will remind me. When I do preparation for these kinds of things, I sometimes find to my chagrin that I have left things out. So I gather up worksheets and I gather up materials and I say, oops. And then, of course, I want to put all kinds of other material out, and this can be annoying to some people. So I will be sending out some notes afterwards to the people who are on the reminder system, which is everyone here, plus 32 people now who say, bother me with an email, which is very nice. And one of the things that I discovered is that I really need to introduce the idealized self-image by talking about Pathwork Guide Lecture 143, which is unity and duality. So this will be brief, but it's really critical to understanding the idealized self-image. The lecture on unity and duality basically proposes that while unity is the actual reality of the universe, that the manifestation here on the earth plane, which is a delightful phrase that the guide uses, here on the earth we have a dualistic perception that is backed up by physics and reality. So the back and forth that we go through with spiritual work is we really can't believe what we see, even though we can. So we want to respect reality as a manifestation of spirituality. But we want to also remember at the same time that it's not real. That we live in a world of illusion, meaning that what we see and feel and experience are manifestations and projections from the spirit world. So it's a hard concept to get. Another thing that the guide says thousands of times in the lectures is that every feeling, every thought creates a world. That in the spirit world, these are just as real as chairs and tables and cement floors are to us. That they have substance, that they have density. But for us, feelings and thoughts only turn real when someone shouts at us or when we manifest something that we can actually feel. So when you feel sad, the light, tender feeling of feeling sad may not seem so big to you. What the guide is saying is in the spirit world, that's just as big as a nuclear explosion and just perhaps more important. So this creates a dichotomy in our head, if we think about it, in that we are supposed to believe what we see and feel and experience. It is being offered to us, and we are co-creators in it. And yet, it's not real. Our real existence is in the unitive plane as spirits. Now, why would I think that that was important in talking about the idealized self-image? Because the idealized self-image is a creation. It's not something you can point to. It's not a profession. It's not a piece of woodwork that you can create with your hands. Even though there are tangible results from your idealized self-image, it's like an energetic vortex that you create. And this energy system that you create in spirit is just as real as your flesh and blood. So that if you live within it, if you immerse yourself in this dynamic, in this psychodrama of who I want to be, that it is spiritually real and that it will affect your life and affect other people in your life because it's real, even though you might not be able to point to it. There's no smoking gun. It's hard to pin things down. And this is where in the work that the majority of pathwork helpers and organizations and so forth are coming to, is we're coming to a realization that we need to work with the energy of a situation. Because in the words and in the actions of people, that's only part of the story. A very, very large part of the story is the energy and the intention that is being exhibited at that time. So that's why I wanted to introduce the concept of the unitive and the dualistic sphere before I went into idealized self-image. So if you see the acronym ISI, it stands for idealized self-image. At one point in the lecture, the guide says that the idealized self-image is the mask. But they're not necessarily interchangeable terms. So the idealized self-image is a whole concept, a whole series of concepts. And the mask is more of a noun or a defense. So the mask is used to barricade. And it barricades with the concepts of the idealized self-image. So there's a difference between the two, but sometimes you can interchange them and you can understand them in a similar way. So for instance, in the worksheets that I put out on the internet, I put out a picture of, it's an old-fashioned picture of something we used years ago in core energetics to show the mask as if it were the outside layer of a circle, protecting the inner layers of a circle. But the truth is that although the mask, of course, has positive aspects to it, everybody has a mask. When I teach the mask, I teach it in terms of like wearing clothing. You wear certain clothing in certain situations, and it does give you a little barrier. It gives you a little decoration in a certain way to blend in. It has all kinds of uses. Everybody uses masks. The problem with masks is when you don't know you're using it. So it's as if you don't know you're wearing an overcoat and you wonder why you can't feel the wind. Well, you're wearing an overcoat. So the mask becomes a problem when we think it's us and we don't realize and we can't make it porous. We can't dissolve it. We can't open up and feel certain things more intensely. So the mask can muffle our sensations, interactions with the rest of the world, and we don't even realize it. What the idealized self-image does is it actually creates a false self, not just a protective barrier, but a false self. And this barrier is designed to ensure happiness, security, and self-confidence. Okay, it's literally that simple. Okay, so the question would be, why do you need to ensure happiness? And we go back again to the concept of duality on this planet. People feel unhappy, and they want to be happy. In the unitive plane, we're not unhappy. We're just processing some sensations. But from a human standpoint, we can't discern that difference. If we feel miserable, it takes a lot of maturity for us to say, I know that I have feelings of misery and I have, but I know I'm actually blissfully happy and I'm just experiencing this for fun. This is not our normal reality. And it also trivializes the process to discard the laboratory, the actual earth plane that we designed to come here and work with. So the problem with the earth plane is that we can't forget it's not real. I use movie analogies a lot. And I remember when The Matrix came out, you had helpers just singing in the streets. We were so jazzed because it said everything Patchwork says. It basically said, it's not real, stupid. And yet the characters would sit there eating steak and enjoying the flavor, saying, I know it's not real, but I like it. And the problem became, and it was beautifully displayed, it was beautifully played with in that film, the problem is that when your sensory apparatus sends you feedback of pain that you interpret in your mind as pain, it is not easy to say this doesn't exist. We're not designed to discard those feelings. We feel them, and you will not stop feeling them, even though they are not technically real in the spirit world. I hope that makes sense. So because this world is so real a laboratory, we are going to get sucked in to the idea that if we're bad, and mommy gets angry and shuts down, that we've just lost love. It is very hard when you are 3 years old not to buy into that scene. And what happens with human beings is we go through that formative imprinting period and we can't help it. We don't have these adult defenses. We don't understand spirituality. We don't meditate and we don't go see therapists. We are dealing on the spot with the possibility that our primal urges and our selfishness and our lack of foresight are going to create a situation where we're going to lose the love that is necessary for our emotional and even our physical survival. And we are designed to think that way. So when a child feels, I want the cookie, and when I take the cookie, my mother gets upset and says she doesn't love me. So taking the cookie is bad. Well, part of us says, no, it's not. I like the cookie and I don't care. But there's another part of us. And that part really wants to honor that it's going to be dinner in a half an hour and that we have to have fortitude and self-discipline and we need to be good. So I'm going to use these words as shorthand. So good is shorthand for acceptable behavior that is approved by the authority figures in our lives and gives us access to more privilege. And there's a reality in that. And bad is shorthand for we might have a chance of arguing this value differential when we're 17, but not when we're 3. When we're 3, we lose the battle. So right-wrong has to do with whether mother is going to listen, not whether you have a valid point of view. So bad becomes determined by the outcome of our interaction with authority figures rather than a separate, independent value judgment. I know this may sound a little complex, and perhaps you can sympathize that if what I'm saying is true, no 3-year-old on the planet can handle it. And that's where we just say good, bad. It's like my brain hurts from all this talk. Just tell me how to get the cookie. I wait an hour and a half till after dinner. Fine. That's what I'll do. And so we tweak ourselves in whatever way we have to create enough fortitude and willingness to perform according to the dictates that we're handed, the parental values, the system of the household that we're growing up in. So again, the idealized self-image is a false self designed to ensure happiness, security, and self-confidence. When you meet a child and it's glowing with politeness, I personally have a hard time believing that. I don't mind a kid being nice, but the glowing with politeness just strikes me as a little too nice. This is the kind of false self that I'm talking about, where I don't believe that children are inherently brilliantly well-mannered. I think they're decent human beings. But sometimes they'll take on a very shiny, bright exterior because they're bartering with adults all the time. And they're trying to meet the absolute expectations of adults rather than being a kid and losing out on some privileges or some advantages sometimes. So this would be one example of where a false self is being developed in childhood in order to attain something. So that's the point one. Second point is that the idealized self-image can choose to either hide negativities, which are not acceptable, or alternatively, it can choose to glorify them. So if you've got a part of you that has some problems, you can shore it up, you can trim, cut, and paste it, you can find out a way to make it palatable to the rest of the world, or you can hide it. Now, either way, you're not being honest. Whatever that so-called negativity is, it's either edited or it's hidden. Okay? And this is one of the reasons why the idealized self-image is false. It doesn't accept the range of human nature. It doesn't accept imperfection. Now, because of that, because the ISI is, it's not real, it can't be 100% free. There's an old-fashioned... My mother tried to make me wear a girdle when I was 12. It didn't work, thank God, but I remember the feeling of being encased in plastic and unable to breathe. That's what the ISI can feel like. It can make us feel like we can't be real. We can't move naturally. We can't respond spontaneously. We need to be careful. So the idealized self-image can be aloof. It needs to make itself invulnerable, and it absolutely, positively has to fit a set of conditions that are known as good. Okay? Sometimes an idealized self-image can work the opposite way. In a group of hoodlums, good becomes what we might call bad. So you have to look at context in this. The idealized self-image of an aristocrat would be different from an idealized self-image of a revolutionary. But they're still working to concepts if they're sitting within the idealized self-image. Any questions? So
well, how does a precocious child fit in with that?
I think it depends very, very much on how that child is met. The word precocious automatically assumes a slightly positive interpretation.
Uh-huh.
Okay? Because one person might see a child as precocious, and the other might see the child as uppity or rude or uncontrollable.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're already working along a certain value path with that word. Does that make sense?
Uh-huh.
Okay. So, yeah, that's how far back it goes. There's a thing that I call baselining, which is a thinking process that I go through, and that is to realize that we're speaking too far along a path when the actual issue lies further behind. And dealing with a word like precocious would be an example of that, because it's already started along, it's past the fork where you make a decision about totally bad or totally good. You may not like precocious, and you may want to put it on a different branch of the tree, but you have taken it out of totally bad behavior by the use of the word precocious. So sometimes it helps when you do some work to realize that you may already have some hidden values in the words or where you're working in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Does that help?
Thank you.
Okay. So the next thing about the ISI is that it makes tyrannical demands. And by that I mean that this is not a passive situation. This is not just a nice piece of clothing that you put on and you don't mind if it gets stained. Okay. This piece of clothing, this mask, this persona that you're presenting to the world, this needs to be spotless. If you're not working with that, you may be working with a real self that allows imperfection. So you want to be very careful to delineate. Sometimes we're not working with an idealized self-image. Sometimes we're working with our real self. So when I talk about this, I'm talking about somebody who is in the grips of needing to feel acceptable to the world, who needs to put on certain attitudes and take on certain, I'm stuck for words. I'm going to have to let that go. Anyway, put on certain attitudes as if they were clothing to present themselves to the world, where holes in your clothing are not acceptable. So I want to make sure we delineate that we're not talking about a little bit of pride or a little bit of I like to be clean or I like to be approved of. We're talking about a whole dynamic here of idealized self-image. So within that idealized self-image, this thing turns into a tyrant. The demands never cease. Because a human being is messy. And a human being has a lot of spontaneous feelings that don't conform to ideologies. That's just not who we are. People both cry and laugh at funerals. It's a very individual, personal reaction to loss and death and family and a lot of other things. But once you have an ideal of what should happen to you or by others at a funeral, then you've got to smash and clip any feelings that occur that don't fit this ideology. And again, that's the difference between an idealized self-image and a simple preference for certain kinds of behavior. So besides making tyrannical demands that we believe certain things and we live certain ways and we do certain things, the ISI can actually create strong feelings of failure, frustration, compulsion, false guilt, false shame, and false needs. And this is what I mean by tyrannical. So by demanding that the only thing that exists be in a certain vein, like a tyrant, it must smash opposition. It must destroy alternative points of view. So that's basically what the idealized self-image is. What I thought I would do is I thought I would go through how the idealized self-image operates using vicious circle. So this vicious circle was discussed in Lecture 50. And what I do with the vicious circle, literally, it's not this simple, but it can be. You draw a circle. And I have found it useful to treat the circle like a clock. So as I go through, I'm going to reference points on a clock, like the 12 hours of a clock, because it helps people in terms of time and space when they're listening to me, and it also helps construct the circle, because you can't see my finger as I point and I circle. I do lots of gesturing, even on the phone. My hands are waving in the air all the time, but you can't see that. So this will hopefully give you a frame of reference that you can visualize in terms of a clock face. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to walk through the dynamic of the idealized self-image. And then I hope that we might get into a place where we discuss different aspects of it, which I welcome your questions for, and also possibly questions. I'm open to questions on anything, this subject or other subject, considering I always bring in half a dozen lectures. I have to be kind of liberal about this. So, using a clock face. Imagine a clock, the visual of a circle, and I want you to imagine three extra loops in this. So, seeing the circle, see if you can imagine adding a little curved line, flipping back from 3 back to 12. I usually don't flip on the inside, but inside or outside. So in other words, you've got a full circle, and then you've got a mini circle going from 12 to 3 and back again. And then a little tiny circle going from 8 back to 6. Okay? So, starting with that image. Starting with 0 hour, midnight, the starting point. What I'm going to suggest is that, and please follow with me with your own examples, that at this entry point into the circle, I'm going to stop for a second. We're talking now about a vicious circle, not a benign circle. There's a difference. So we're specifically talking about a dynamic of activity that continues to repeat itself. And I'm going to talk about exit points, but I'm primarily talking about being trapped in hamster wheel. So I'm not talking about any situation. I'm talking about a recurring spiral, recurring drama. So in the beginning, at 0 hour, we are inspired by our higher self and our connection to the divine. Now, the higher self, I remember somebody saying that in the circles of higher self, lower self mask, the higher self is in the center and it's very small, but higher self doesn't really care because it's not into status. And it really doesn't care what you think of it, it is. So the higher self could be allotted a postage stamp amount of space in the cosmos, and it would say, that's great, I'm everything in this postage stamp. I don't need land, I don't need fame, I don't need fortune, and I don't need to shout. So when you hear your higher self voice, it will never be specific. the higher self does not say, I want the red dress. The higher self voice does not say, take that job. The higher self voice is speaking from a larger place in you that simply wants good to occur, that simply wants to bring forth positive intentionality. And it knows better than the other parts of us that the attitude with which you do something is far more important than the specifics around that action. So when a higher self voice comes in, if you ever hear it be specific or demanding, automatically that is not a higher self voice. It could be a multitude of other voices that we can name and talk about and have jargon for, but it's not the higher self voice. So the higher self voice is not attached to how things manifest, and it is never specific on an earth plane level. Okay, it might say, please don't do that, but it doesn't tell you what to do. So as an example of this, you might use, the higher self voice might say, I want to be good or generous or kind or loving. It might say all of those things. And that's the voice that comes into this circle. I want to be good. I want to be generous. And the rest of you, your job is to figure out how to manifest that. So the intention is lovely, and what we do is we go around looking for a place to make this real. So at the 1 o'clock mark, we attempt to manifest this higher self desire. So this is going to get somewhat specific, okay? But it doesn't have a forcing current or an agenda. So what this might look like is, my friend could use some help. Now, if you listen very, very carefully to my friend could use some help, there is, in fact, an invisible or in that. There is an assumed duality. My friend could use some help can contain or unhappiness will result. I'm going to repeat this because for me it's very, very important. The simple phrase, my friend could use some help, can contain an invisible sentence that says, or unhappiness could result. If it does, that unspoken duality is going to get you in trouble. If that unspoken duality was not here, we would not be going into a vicious circle. If it's clean, you're not in a vicious circle. But if it's dirty, we continue. Position number two. You experience some resistance. This would happen partly because your sentence isn't clean, because there's a little push in my friend could use some help, where you want to give it because you have an agenda or an idea or a judgment on what should happen versus what should not happen. In effect, you're getting dirtier. Okay? In a benign circle, this is one of the places where you might re-examine your inspiration and check it out. But again, we're in a vicious circle in this example, so we're going to go on. At point number three, you start to realize that something's going wrong. Your friend may need help, but it's not happening. Either they are resistant, or you can't offer it, or you've tried to offer it and it hasn't worked. Again, if another result comes up, you're out of the vicious circle. So at point three, there's a growing sense that something has gone wrong. And the sense that starts to come up is feelings of inadequacy. Wondering, because I'm failing, I wonder if I'm doing something wrong or something is wrong. And at position four, a decision is made to push forward. So I like to think of this like a roller coaster, where you start to fall downwards and you start to gain momentum. So at position four, you make a decision to start pushing. I can't quit now, maybe another way will work. But it's not a decision to revisit the issue. At position five, your discomfort increases, but your resolve hardens. You feel forced to choose, either give up or commit further. By position six, you may become convinced that what you're trying to do is a good thing, and it's the rest of the world that has a problem. Now, to do that, you need to feel justified. You need to build up the sense of having a cause. You need to go through the list of why you're in the right place and somebody else may not be. So this is the place where you are leaning against or enwrapped in feelings of the idealized self-image. I'm going to read a quote here from Lecture 83 at this point. Since the standards and dictates of the idealized self are impossible to realize, yet never giving up the attempt, you keep and cultivate within yourself an inner tyranny of the worst order. The original insecurity, supposed to be whisked away by the establishment of the idealized self, steadily increases. It snowballs and becomes worse and worse. The more insecure you feel, the more stringent the demands of the superstructure, the idealized self, the less you are able to live up to it, and the more insecure you feel. So now we're at the bottom of the... bottom of the hour, I think is what they call it. It's a very nice phrase. We're at the bottom of the hour. Just like a roller coaster with dynamics, now we're trying to basically climb out of the pit. We're down there with the idealized self-image. We have convinced ourselves that we're right, that we have a cause, that we're supposed to be doing something. We've pushed and shoved. Something's gone wrong. It's not working. And we're trying to make it work. So we're scrambling to get out of this pit. I rather like the image of the circle at this point, which is why I use the clock. As a sidebar, there's a lovely quality here in the climbing out of the pit that I choose to honor. And that is that people don't quit. That they don't just sit and stagnate. It is physically impossible, it is mentally and emotionally impossible, and it is spiritually impossible. And it really is our salvation. So the reality is that negativity is boring. It's tight and constrictive and doesn't give us any place to breathe. So the nature of life and movement brings salvation. It brings the opportunity to break loose. So at position seven, we sense the pretense. We start to realize that something's not right, and we start to look for it. That little loop that I described between eight and six, going round and round and round, is a miniature vicious circle, where we may sense the pretense, but our imperfections and mistakes are used against us by ourselves. Under the tyranny of the idealized self-image, we succumb to its apparent perfection. Understand that to argue with your ISI is to argue with your ideals. That's the origin of the word idealized self-image. And it's powerful because it incorporates your dreams. It is using your very higher self against you. So if you argue against what you believe in your heart to be good, you're bad. And so the idealized self-image is holding high ground here. It says, how can you argue against what's good? And this is why it's hard to get out of this. It's hard to find a way. So again, a quote from the lecture says, thereby, further vicious circles come into existence. The more you take out of that live center in order to invest into the robot that you have created, the more estranged you become from the real self, and the more you weaken and impoverish it. So here what we're talking about is the more you feed this demon, this gloating good thing, the less real you are, the less tolerant you are of your own imperfections, of your own state of development. So there's a place where we judge our development instead of simply saying, I'm not the best being in the universe. Never was, never will be. On a scale of 1 to 10, if I'm 6.5, that's probably pretty good. But that doesn't sound good to ourselves. We really want to be good. We want to be best. We want to see improvement. And while on a spiritual level we are improving ourselves, on a human level we have much less patience than the spirit world. So in that little mini loop between 6 and 8, we may basically flip ourselves over like an Aikido or a judo trick, stumbling over our own seduction to our own ideals. Now, I'm going to describe the rest of the circle as a vicious circle. It doesn't have to happen this way, but this is how it happens as a vicious circle. At 9, our imperfections, at 9, we feel the need to choose good over bad. Okay, good is good and bad is bad, and I'm going to make this happen. My friend is going to get help, and I'm going to go for it no matter what. I'm going to devote 1,000% of my energy, and we're going to fix this problem. Can you hear the forcing current in that? Can you hear that there's no reevaluation of what your friend might want? Or what help might be? Or whether your friend is ready for help or needs a break? I can name a lot of examples of good intentioned efforts that go astray because we're enforcing it on ourselves or on others. So at 9, we wake up and say, man, let's go. Let's haul. Let's do it. Okay? And we break out of the pity pot down at the bottom of the hour, but we're not clean. So we rush through 10 and 11 inside a forcing current, okay, remembering our longing, but blinded by our idealized self-images version of how we should manifest it. So as a quote from the lecture, needless to say, you also have to recognize most particularly and in detail what your specific demands and standards are. And further, you have to see in their unreasonableness their impossibility. But as we leap past 9, 10, and 11, we're simply going to make this work. So we're headed for 1. We're headed for how to manifest be good, generous, love, and be good, generous, kind, and loving without examining whether we're actually carrying that energy or something else with it. So I'm hoping that gives you a sense of how a vicious circle of idealized self-image might work. Now, there are exit points in the vicious circle. One is the little loop from 12 to 3. Anywhere in there, before you get fully invested in what you're doing, you can wander back and say, what was that idea? And what way was I going to manifest it, and is that way appropriate? The second place to exit a vicious circle, it's really hard when we're in the dynamics. That's a very difficult place to pull the plug. The second place is in the 8 or 9 position, when we start to get the feeling that there's an urgency, a forcing current here, and we are able to disengage from it. That's a hard thing to do. One of the ways we do that is explained in the lecture, The Spiritual Meaning of Crisis. And I say this with some amount of humor. It crashes and burns, and then you can't fix it. And that's what the spiritual meaning of crisis says. That sometimes the option is taken away from you. And that actually frees you to look at things differently. And in that moment of being free from, for instance, let me digress a second, a house burning down with all your possessions and your favorite belongings is a terrible thing. It's awful. But if you were tied to old memories, think for a second about the positive. That for all the things that you do lose, there's a place where you are free of old memories in a way that you could not be if somebody said, pack a bag and come with me, and you had to choose from all these things. It's very painful to select from among a lifetime of possessions what you want to take in a single suitcase. But if a tornado comes, and all you can do is throw things in a paper bag and run out of the house, the emergency takes care of it for you. And after all those things do exist in your mind. And you can reconstruct the memories. It is easier sometimes to look at a paper elephant or a statue or a favorite book with a writing in it by a friend. It brings back things in floods. Very powerful. But if those things truly happened, they exist. And you can bring them back without the thing to help you with. So the spiritual meaning of crisis basically says, sometimes that's what it takes, and that's why crisis is given to us. Not because we're bad, but because at this point, a severance is the best way for us to become free. So I'm going to pause for a second because it's 5 to the hour, and I need to cut this recording to make it possible to mount and